Welcome back, everybody. My guest, John Brown, Missouri All-American, Olympian. We're going to talk a little bit about the Olympics a little bit later on. And NBA star, just a great basketball player and even a better person. John, before the break, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the differences between being coached at the high school level, being coached at the college level, and being coached at the NBA level. You know, and I think most of us have in our mind that your high school coaches, you know, they can kind of get you ready, but you really learn the fundamentals and the right things to do and how to do it and the right way to play and everything. It seems that that happens a lot of times at the college level. And then at the pro level, I think a lot of people think there isn't any coaching at all. They just kind of roll the ball out. Set us straight on some of that, would you?
You know, you're probably right to some degree. Although the guy that took us over fifth, sixth grade was really good fundamentally. And whether it was the mic and drill, which I think is invaluable. I mean, I've used it my whole life to really for be nimble around the basket, be able to reverse, do different things, pivot, that the mic and drill is so good for. But just ball handling drills and that sort of thing, you kind of, every kid usually does that. But once you get into college, then things take on a more serious tone. You know, coaches making money and there's people are paying money to go to games and it's on TV and what have you. So there's a whole new level of seriousness. But I think, you know, for the first time, you know, high school, you can't recruit. You just have whoever shows up. In college, then you try to, these guys are melded together and you pick a center and you pick this guy that might play well with this guy. And the coach hopes that he does a good job of putting guys together. But I know one, I remember one day when Stuart said, okay, everybody's got to do the mic and drill. You have to make 12 in a row before we quit. And I thought to myself, 12 in a row, I said, I can make 500 of those. That's all I did, you know. But I was ahead on fundamentals because as you go through as a basketball player, and we go all the way to pro basketball, your good players, they never give up the fundamentals. I would go out and do, if I was going out and play today, I would do the mic and drill. You know, I would do some little bit of ball handling. I might dribble up down the floor a couple times, do certain things. I would do fundamentals. The good players are going to do fundamentals every day, I think. And I you're probably the same way. But you get up to a basketball court, you don't just say, let's just play. You're going to go through, most guys are going to go through a little routine and they're going to do their fundamentals. And I think that's somewhat lost maybe today. I think I see a lot of players who are not fundamentally sound, but we talk about how coaches change from one level to the other. You know, you're strong in fundamentals. I was in high school, in college. And then I had Cotton Fitzsimmons, who was actually pretty good on fundamentals also. But they do expect you in pro basketball to kind of have all that and or do it on your own. So you get to practice and you start running plays and that sort of thing. So there is a big difference as you go up and down on the fundamental level. To me, that's something every player has got to do every time you play. 5-10 minutes of fundamentals. And I don't think you see that very much today.
You know, interestingly, you mentioned the mic and drill. This is kind of a short side story, but in December I had an opportunity to go out and watch my grandson play in an AAU tournament in Phoenix. And I walked on the court, and they actually asked me to coach them because their coach couldn't make it. He, from California, he couldn't make it in, so they asked me to coach, which was a huge mistake on their part. But I see this kid.
I doubt that.
I see this kid, about 6'3", 6'4", and he's out there, and he's doing the mic and drill. And he's a teammate of my grandson. And I look over there, and I say, who is that kid? And they said, George Mikan. And I said, what? Mikan doing the Mikan drill? Oh, come on. What's the kid's name? He said, no, it's George Mikan. I said, George Mikan? He said, yeah, his grandpa is George Mikan. So that I actually got to coach George Mikan's grandson, and I got to watch him, the George Mikan doing the George Mikan drill.
I'm going, that is incredible. That is incredible.
It is. You know, and I saw his dad, and his dad was, oh, probably 10 years older than me. And I'm thinking, my goodness, that guy had a child really late in life. Because I didn't think.
He had to, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that was kind of a side comment on it. Who was your Olympic coach?
Well, we had Hank Iba, legendary Hank Iba. And then Hank was starting to lose his voice somewhat. And so Don Haskins from UTEP. Oh.
Yeah,
Texas El Paso, a very famous coach, was our assistant coach. And he was kind of the foghorn that shouted out the instruction. Because Iba had lost his voice somewhat because of his age, Don shouted out the instructions in a very deep voice and very commanding voice. And he kind of did most of the coaching in practice. Mm. And then games, Hank Iba would do most of the strategizing, the type of offense and stuff that we ran.
And I didn't know much about Iba other than he was legendary, but it seemed like he was a slow down type coach, you know, very methodical and, you'd take forever to get an offensive basket because of his style. Was that the type of style he tried to use? First of all, was that the style that he had, number one? Number two, did he try and use that with the Olympic team?
I don't think there was a slower style. From day one on the Olympic team, all we talked about was Russians and how they played and how we would combat the Russians. And as you know, 1972 is the first year the Russians ever beat us. That was that team that I was on. And He knew they were going to be very, very strong. In hindsight, they were a little stronger than they probably should have been. If you remember, the German women were caught on steroids, and it's very possible that was going on at that time with the Russians.
Now, you didn't get an opportunity to play, and you and I had talked about this one other time quite some time ago, but you were starting on that team. And then right the game before, you had an exhibition right before your very first Olympic game and you got hurt. Is that what happened?
Well, we had three practices a day in Pearl Harbor. And on the last practice of the last day, I sprained my ankle and broke a bone in my foot. I didn't know it was broken at the time. So we went and played a couple of pro NBA teams in the United States in preparation for Munich. And about 4 or 5 days before they were ready to fly to Munich, they x-rayed. They thought it was a sprained ankle because I couldn't run on it, couldn't cut on it. And they did another x-ray in LA and they found that it was broken. My fourth metatarsus was broken. And honestly, that was the most difficult evening of my life when I knew that I wasn't going to get to play on that team, because these days they would have taken me over and I'd have been on all the pictures and all that stuff. But the budgets were smaller back then. And honestly, I needed to probably get back and get some treatment, whether it was a cast or whatever, or bone graft or whatever was going to happen, to prepare for my senior year in college. So I was a starter on that team. Honestly, what happened was Hank Iba took myself and Swin Nader aside at the start of the Olympic tryout camp in Colorado Springs. And we had our picture taken with Hank in front of the main building. And we were the only two players picked. And I know he was thinking about guys like us to beat the Russians. So I think that he kind of had me preselected to fulfill a role. And to this day, I feel like had I not gotten hurt, I really think we would have won. Because the Russians had a guy named Belov that scored 30.
Yeah.
And of all the guys I've played, the Dr. J's and the Bob McAdoo's and some of the great players on the planet, hardly anybody ever got over 15, 16, 17, 18 points on. And I'd get my 10 or 12 and it'd be a draw, in my mind. But no one ever went off like that. And I think I could have made a difference mm-hmm. in that game. And I don't think it would have been a close game at the end because I don't think he would have got 30 points. But that's history. Who knows, you know? That's just the way I feel about it.
Well, I've played enough with you knowing that you aren't going to be moved. I don't care how big and strong he was. You got
not by a guy my size. He was 6'7", 6'8" guy.
Yeah.
And premature abuse or something. But he didn't last very long. I think he died 10 or 15 years later. And I'm just certain that Belov would not have gotten 30 points against us. He's the guy that beat us and actually scored the winning basket in the game. He went up for the ball at the very end. Two guys get knocked down on the floor, and then he goes up for an uncontested play. And it's very, complicated, far more complicated than that, but exactly what happened at the end with the shot, the clock being run back 3 seconds on multiple occasions.
Yeah.
Everybody speaking different languages at the scores table and referees and us. No one could communicate. And as a result, the silver medal that we were supposed to get is still in a vault in Switzerland. We never accepted the silver medal. We feel like we were, taken advantage of.
Yeah. Now, who are some of your teammates on that team? Who were the starters before you got hurt?
Well, it would have been Doug Collins. We had Ratliff from San Diego State. We had Bobby was just a sophomore when I was a junior. He wasn't quite as good yet as he turned out to be later. I mean, I was probably as good as I was ever going to be my junior year, and then the next 3 or 4 years, I was the peak of my game. Tom Burleson was 7'4", but he did not start at North Carolina State. But we had a guy named Jim Brewer. We had Dwight Jones, 6'10", who ended up playing. We played together in Atlanta. Dwight and I did. We were the 9th and 10th players picked in the draft by Atlanta. Plenty of good enough players to have won that handily. But like I say, the confusion at the end was, you just have to go back in the history books and look at it. And there's videos on it, and there's movies on it, books written about it. And it never happened in Olympics. And there is precedent for going back and awarding double gold medals. And we've always hoped that someday they could do that, but it's never happened.
Hmm. Was playing in the NBA what you thought it would be?
You know, in the beginning, here I'm a guy that hasn't seen that much of the world. You know, go to University of Colorado, Oklahoma, and around the Big Eight. But you know, you go to Portland for the first time, you're going to LA for the first time, you're in San Francisco, you're in New York, and you're in Boston. That first couple of years, I mean, I was just a sightseeing. Every chance I got when I got to town, if I had, after practice was over, of course you play, you might be on the road for a week, you might play 3 or 4 games, so you have some days off there, and you got time to travel and stuff. But, ultimately, after, you know, I played 7 years, roughly 7 years, and the travel in the end gets to you because you're gone 100 days a year. And they try to, you know, back then we flew commercial airlines. We didn't, I think most of the teams today have private jets, and they leave after the game. And they, you know yourself after you play a basketball game, you can't sleep powers. Your metabolism is high, and you think about the game. It's hard to go to sleep. Well, during that time period, those guys are arriving in the next town. So maybe they get in at midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, whatever, and then they get a decent night's sleep. But back in those days, we had a rule that you had to take the first flight to the next town in case of fog or bad weather or any other reasons. You had to get to that town to the next venue. So a lot of times you're getting up, you might have a 6 o'clock flight, so you'd have to get up at 4, 5 o'clock. And then, you get into the next town, you try to take a nap. You know, it's difficult. You know, that part, I love basketball. I love playing basketball in the NBA, but the traveling would take a toll on people, but it's easier today. I will say that people like LeBron and these people have been raised on private jets and much easier to go. And, it was tougher back then. And of course, you know, the generation before us was all busts. So, you know, at least we got to fly around, you know.
That's right.
You can't complain too much.
Now, you played for the Hawks, I think, for maybe 5 years or so, and then I think you got traded to the Bulls. And I think you were only there for a year or two, and then you went to Europe. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Which part, going to Europe or the whole?
Well, you know, you were playing for the Bulls. What was the thing that caused you to go to Europe instead of just continuing to play in the NBA?
Well, I got married my fifth year, and I had a son. Born in Chicago. And the next year, I was due for a contract. And Chicago kept calling and say, John, just come back here to pay X amount of dollars. The Bulls didn't want to guarantee it. They said, you're not going to have any problems being on the team and all that. And I wherever I played, I always played. I either started where I'd played 20 minutes a night. I always played a lot, so I wasn't concerned with that. But having a son, the Italian teams were willing to give me guaranteed money. And there was a situation with taxes then. And what you earned overseas became a tax credit. And so I played over there 3 years, and I had all these tax credits built up, huge amount of tax credits. And I didn't pay federal, I had to pay federal taxes for years and years and years because of playing over there. So the combination of my salary and the tax situation made it a smarter move for me to play over there. And honestly, I needed something different. You know, they played 26 games average over there, and I was kind of worn out from all the travel, the daily travel. And I always did want to play 1 year in Italy. Regardless, because I wanted to see the world my last year. It just so happened it started a couple of years earlier because of a child and wanting to be guaranteed money. And it really was good for me. I played with a guy named Chuck Jura, who was from the University of Nebraska. We had a great run, both averaged probably in the mid-20s on our team and had great teams, had a lot of fun. I wouldn't take back those years for anything. I had more fun in those years than I did in the NBA.
Yeah. How many years were you playing in Europe?
I played 3 years. I played 2 years in Venice and 1 year in Rome.
Mm.
So not bad. Not bad.
That is sweet. And to be able to travel and see, I mean, if you don't play a lot of games, I know that you'd go back to Europe, at least before COVID, you were going back to Europe and taking your family and actually, you knew your way around. And
I wasn't fluent, but I knew enough to really enjoy myself and get around the country and be understood. But Italy, you know, Italy's just, it's got such warm-hearted people, and they have a different relaxed style versus Americans. Just like when you go sit down at a restaurant, that the meal might take 2 hours. And that first drove me crazy at the beginning because you're used to eating and getting out the door, you know, in America. And they, you know, you get an appetizer and you wait 15 minutes, and then you get this and you wait 15 minutes, you get a salad and you wait 15 minutes, and you get an entree, and then you have a dessert, you know, and then you have a coffee, you know, cafe afterwards, you know. So it's spread out. It's spread out for a reason, though. The social part of it is huge, and it's so much healthier. Just the mental part of it. And I got to where I really enjoyed those long meals. And I'll never forget, I had an Italian teammate come over and visit me, Brian. He wanted to go to the Show Me games and watch us. And he came to Rolla, and we were hungry. And that's the first time he ever had fast food. And here he is eating food on his lap. He says, "You eat food on your lap in America? That's never happened before." You know, they're used to the, you know, 2 hour meal at a restaurant, the whole nine yards. And here he's eating a burger in his lap, you know, but it's just a different culture. And, it's like when I first went to Italy, if you wanted a Coke, they just pulled one off the back shelf. It was called Natural. It was just warm, just off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And then Coca-Cola started putting billboards up where it would have a cup of Coke with ice. And the next thing you know, they started serving it cold with ice. So Coca-Cola actually changed their culture a little bit. It changed while I was there.
Interesting.
But yeah, great times over there, great teammates over there, and wouldn't take any of that back.
What a great experience. You had talked about money, and we've had this conversation too before about there are so many guys who actually played in the NBA and made good money that are practically broke now. And I know that didn't happen to you, but can you tell us a little bit as to what your mindset was going into a profession where you knew it was a short-term profession? I mean, you only have so many years you can play. But you do make really good money, or at least they make unbelievable money now in a short period of time. How did you avoid that situation that a lot of the NBA players or the pro football players, what have you, they're broke, you know, 3 or 4 years after their career ends?
I think my very first mentor, he once said, John, the way to true wealth and power is the ownership of land. And I never forgot that. When I started playing, I felt like land to me meant multifamily, having some apartments. And I wasn't a very good saver, but a mortgage is a forced savings program. Mm-hmm. Every time you make that mortgage payment, you know, you're really saving money. You're paying some principal, and of course you're paying interest, which helps on taxes. So, you know, one thing built upon another, whether it's one fourplex until it led to a second fourplex, and you know, building, you know, I built a lot of apartments over the years, and just the power of mortgages, paid off mortgages, has worked for me. And I have to admit, I worked hard. You know, I did a lot of maintenance stuff myself in the beginning, you know, hot water heater elements and paint jobs and all that stuff. I worked hard to understand the business. Eventually I was big enough to have a staff, eventually first started out one lady who would rent them and do bookwork, another guy to do maintenance. And now we have 5 people in management and 3 people in maintenance and 3 people in the yard, you know, yard work. And it, you know, as you get bigger, the scale, economics works for you. But, I would just say my love of real estate, had I chose restaurants or something, I might have gone broke. I don't know. I just chose something that I thought was manageable for me. And I was in a college town that I knew that there would always be a good supply of renters. And Rolla, Missouri has been a good town for that. But, you know, like I said, I've had risks. I paid mortgage payments for many, many, many years. And, you know, that as that, and I, of course you build up cash flow over time. And now I'm sitting in a really good, really great position actually. Mm-hmm. But it's all credited to real estate. So.
Okay. When we,
I know a lot of guys go, you know, they went through divorces and they went through, bad agents who took money from them. You know the stories. It's not all their fault. A lot of these guys were taken advantage of through, I'm not saying, you know, a divorce is being taken advantage of, but just, you know, bad luck or whatever. And then agents, and then maybe agents making bad deals for them. So it's, sometimes it's not all their fault. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. And maybe I was just lucky. I always managed my own money. I never let anybody else touch my situation. I did my own thing. If I was going to make it, I was going to make it on my own. I was going to fail.
Yeah, I think just personally, having known you, you've got a good mind, a good business mind. You're very commonsensical. Whereas, and I don't think you were, I know you weren't wealthy by any stretch of the imagination growing up. So you appreciated the value of a dollar. I'm not sure that a lot of the guys that go to the NBA have that same appreciation. I mean, they practically have nothing, and then all at once they've got everything. And you see, you know, they have their entourages and, you know, they're going to buy three or four or five or six cars and, you know, three houses. And before you know it, they just don't have any money left. And it's really sad. I know when we were, I'll never forget when we were down in Houston playing in that Senior Olympics 3-on-3, we're standing in the lobby of the hotel waiting to check in, and the cab driver comes in. and he looks and he sees Rich Neiman with us, and Neiman's 7 foot, you know, and he looks at Rich and he says, "Hey, did you play in the NBA?" And Rich said, "Yeah, I was there a little while." And he said, "Well, I did too. I played for the Atlanta Hawks." And Rich goes, "Really? Well, so did our teammate over here, John Brown." And the guy goes, "JB, JB." And he was screaming, "JB, JB." And you were on the other side of the lobby, and everybody stopped. I mean, it was a very crowded lobby because a lot of people were checking in at that time. And he goes over, "JB, JB." And you go, and you didn't recognize him. You know, "Do I know you?" And he goes, "JB, you were my power forward." And I know you were just searching, "God, who did I play with in college or maybe high school or something? How do I know this guy?" And it just went on and on. It was kind of embarrassing because he would not tell you his name. And finally, he tells you, and it's John Drew, who was the small forward, starting small forward for your Hawks team. And I don't know if he was all NBA or not, but I think he was your highest paid player on that team. And here he is now driving a cab. You know, there's nothing wrong with driving a cab, but I think he was driving a cab because he had to drive a cab in order to make a living. So that was the craziest story.
Well, when I knew John from Atlanta days, he had a really strong Cajun accent, and he was thin, really thin.
Yeah.
And this guy that came up to us was built much bigger, big, face filled out, body filled out, not fat, just big guy. You know how people get bigger as they get older. And he lost his Cajun accent. And so I had a hard time. I mean, finally listened to him long enough and convincing enough, he finally said John Drew, and it was all thrown together. But I felt kind of bad that I couldn't remember, because John Drew was a great pro. He was on the All-Star team a couple of years. And John, like you said, John made big bucks. I mean, back in those days, he'd make $400,000 to $500,000 a year, which doesn't seem like much now, but it was a lot of money back then. And he may have made more than that. But unfortunately for John, I mean, he got into some drug situations and who knows what else. And it can go in a hurry, you know, when those things happen.
Yeah. John, I think we're going to take another break. When we come back, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of your favorite players, you know, and in my book, I talk about players that make plays, and it'd be interesting to know who you felt were the types of guys that could make plays at the NBA level, and even going back to college, if you have thoughts about that too. So when we come back, let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay.